Blessings are free to be blessed now. Thank you very much for inviting me to be here tonight. I want to thank the committee or whoever puts on this thing for inviting me and for you. I've been in town, went down and had dinner tonight at the beautiful hotel right in downtown Fresno, and looking up over the many floors up over the ground. It's just wonderful to be in Fresno. I don't know whether you feel like it's wonderful to be in Fresno, but you got to not be in Fresno for a long time to feel like it's wonderful to be in Fresno, and I haven't been in Fresno for a real long time. So it's wonderful to be in Fresno. I'm a real alcoholic, and it's great to be in an AA meeting. It's an honor to be in an AA meeting, and it's a distinct honor to be asked to speak anywhere at any time about our fellowship. It's awfully cold. Don't you agree tonight that it's cold? Am I the only person in the room that's cold? I'm cold. I think the antifreeze has all gone out of me, and it's hard to get used to being on the antifreeze, but I'm not. But we're gonna warm up to the subject here. I think I'll start at the beginning. I was born thirsty. I was born in the same year that Alcoholics Anonymous got started. In fact, I was born a few months before the program got started. I was born in February of 1935, and in June, on June 10th, Bob and Bill got together and back in Ohio, and that was the very first meeting between anybody in the whole world. So I was laying over in Arizona from February to June waiting for those guys to get some kind of program started, because I really do believe that I'm one of those kinds of people that came onto the globe an alcoholic. They told me that in the hospital that I went to, but I firmly believe it. I don't, you know, they talk about crossing a line or things getting bad, or you drink for a while and things begin to crowd in on you. My experience was that I started running. I never remember having a social drink. I have four older brothers, all of them alcoholics. Two of them have died from the drink result of our disease. One of my brothers has been able to stay sober for many years due to religion, and my hat is off to him. Bill Wilson tells us that ours is not the only way, but it certainly is a preferred way. But anyway, as I grew up and started going to school, and just like all of us, I found out when I was just a very young guy, about 11 years old, my family went back to the family farm back in Wisconsin, back in Marion, Wisconsin. And there was a great number of beer drinkers and stuff around there, and I'm just an 11-year-old kid. But I had a cousin back on the farm, and he felt kind of sorry for me because I was just the little kid that never got anything to drink. And he told me one day, he says, "Come here, I want to show you something." He took me out into this barn, this beautiful farm back in Wisconsin. And back in Wisconsin, they cut hay and stuff in the few summer months before the winter, and they put it out in the barn for the stock to eat all winter long. And he showed me a hole that he made in the hay. And way back as far as you could reach, the whole length of my arm, he had bought me a quart bottle of Virginia Dare wine. And he says, "Now, I'll tell you what, John," he said, this guy's about 22 years old, but he said, "I went downtown today and I bought this bottle of wine, and it's right here in this hole, and you're the only one that knows about it. And anytime you'd like to have a drink, and the grown-ups are drinking, just come out, sneak out to the barn, and you can have a drink." And he says, "I got a whole quart. We were going to be there all summer." He says, "I'm sure it'll last the whole summer for you, you know, and that way I can have a nip." He's just being kind of a gentlemanly guy. That night, the bottle was gone. I drank the whole thing in one day, 11-year-old kid, got completely bottled, peed my pants, went downtown to where they were having a movie, went into the ladies' room, stuffed up the toilet, and it overflowed. The manager was mad at me. I made a complete fool out of myself on my very first shot. The next day, here I am, an 11-year-old kid, throwing up, sick as a dog, and that was the beginning of my drinking career. That's how I kind of like eased into things. And that's just the way it was. Now, I'm one of those alcoholics, though, that was able to be what I guess what they call a working or a erect or a vertical alcoholic. I was able to continue on through school, and I was shortly afterwards, by the way, on that trip to Wisconsin at the end of that particular year. That was in 1946. I did get really sick, and I got polio, and that's why I'm in a wheelchair today, because I got polio back just about 3 years before they invented the polio vaccine. So the reason I'm handicapped is because of poliomyelitis, infantile paralysis, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, I went, that was all right. It worked out fine. I got out of the hospital after a couple of years, went to high school, and was very, very interested in all the things that happened in school. I ran for all the, I was president of this and president of that, president of the band. I was student body president. Just had a wonderful time. But about every second or third weekend, I would get drunk. Never had a social drink. I could never kind of ease into it. I always drank too much and got drunk and had something unpleasant happen. Usually some kind of a lack of control of my kidneys or a little bit of a wreck or something or broke something or knocked something over. I was constantly in trouble, but I couldn't put the two together. When I didn't drink, I was a pretty good student and a nice guy, and I worked the everything seemed to go along just fine, but these things kept creeping up on me and having too much to drink and having these problems. But these were all through the teenage years. When I got out of high school, I went to, fell in love with the broadcasting business, which is another story, and I went to a radio engineering school, learned how to become an engineer and a broadcast engineer, got into broadcasting and television. Oh, it was just wonderful. It was just perfect. It was great to be, I was in a wheelchair, I didn't have to walk, because I could talk on the radio and broadcast sporting events, etc., and was making a good living. But even then, I would notice, every once in a while, I'd overshoot that mark. I didn't want to. I loved my work. I loved being in broadcasting. I just wanted to be a nice guy, but I kept going with the guys, have a few drinks, and I was always the one that seemed to end up going into a blackout and crossing over and going too far and have hangovers. My God, I used to have the most horrible, terrible, debilitating, throwing up, bad stomach, Jesus, for a couple of days, swear I'd never drink again. And of course, I always drank again. And I always able to work pretty good, too, continued to work. And then I fell in love one time. I'm doing this whole thing so I can get into my sober, because I'm going to talk about my sober life and the drunk life. But I went into this world of broadcasting, and in 1968, I'll never forget, I fell in love accidentally with politics. Those of you who, this great state of California, which is a fabulous political state, back in 1968, there was an enormous upwelling of interest in our state about unionism. The Republicans wanted to do away with unions. They had a thing called right to work. And the Democrats and all the labor unions and everybody came up and killed this bill called right to work. And I was just, I was born in 35, this is 58, so I figured out I was like 23, 24 years of age. And I got interested in this thing and began to work a little bit in politics. Met everybody, Pat Brown, and all the people that were running for office. And I got very interested in public life and decided to run for office, my God. And I did that. I got elected. I still can't believe it. Actually went out and talked to people and BS'd a little bit. And they had the election. I got elected to the city of San Bernardino City Council. This is back in 1959. And it was just wonderful. I just couldn't believe what a wonderful honor that was. And I can remember there was a guy who was the city mayor, a guy named Raymond H. Gregory, got elected at the same time. And he called me up to the house a couple of days before we were sworn into office, gave me a book. And he says, John, they tell me that I get to appoint members of the city council with certain boards and commissions. And he says, you and I are going in together. I don't know those guys down there. They've all been there for a while. But I feel kind of in a kinship toward you. So he said, I want you to look through this book, and you can pick four appointments that you want, and I'll give them to you, and then I'll give the rest of them to the other guys. Seems fair to me. So I'm leaping through the book. And there's all interesting things like public buildings and parks and finance committee and all this stuff. And I look down and turn the page, police commissioner, it says. Police commissioner. God damn, that had a ring to it, you know? I said, I'd like that one right there. You got it. So the next Monday, we were sworn into office. I go over to the San Bernardino City Police Department, right where they booked the prisoners. They booked me, except that what they were doing is to take my picture for a laminated card, bring it out to me. I still have it at home, beautiful card like this. John P. Quimby, Police Commissioner, City of San Bernardino. Now, if that wasn't wonderful, I put that bugger in my pocket, and away we go. That's just, let me tell you something. You do not, I find out, get arrested for drunk driving in the city of San Bernardino when you're the police commissioner. Isn't that wonderful?
I don't know how it worked, it just nobody ever arrested me. Believe me, I didn't stop drinking because I still had that annoying habit of going for one or two weeks or three and maybe, and then I'd hit that time where I would go on over that line, make a fool out of myself, throw up, fall down, get into some kind of trouble. But now I had someone to drive me home. I served for 4 years in that position, enjoyed it, loved it very much. When I found out that the man who was the state assemblyman had decided to run up for a higher office, called me up and offered if I could run for that office. This is in 1962, and I said, why not? Let's go. And I'll be a son of a gun, ladies and gentlemen. I know it's going to be hard for you to believe, but I'm here tonight to tell you that in the June primary of that year, in 1973 or whatever it was, 63 rather, 62, I got elected. I got more votes than anybody else in the campaign. I couldn't believe it. I'd never been to Sacramento. I didn't know where it was. And I'd been elected to the California State Legislature. I'm only 26, 27 years old. I still got this. I'm married at that time. I met a lovely lady, and I actually was married for my second time. The first one I couldn't hardly see go by. But the second one, I'm married to this very impressive lady. Got two or three little kids. I'm working at the radio station. I got a nice name. I'm the city police commissioner. I'll be the son of a gun if the people in that county didn't elect me to the state assembly. I took office on January 1st, 1963. That was back in the days before what they call full-time legislature. So you can take your wife and kids. Everybody would go to Sacramento for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months. And I came up to Sacramento and got sworn in. And there was Pat Brown, my old friend, who was the governor, and all these people. And I, you know, as an alcoholic, with an alcoholic personality, and all of this incredibleness that most of us have, which is a superior feeling but with an inferiority complex, you can imagine how I felt. I was surprised that I was there. I couldn't believe that I was there. But on the other hand, it was a kind of an ego, self-centered, healthy on one side, and it was a very mind-blowing thing. But what the hell, I took the oath of office, got sworn into office, and here I am in this California legislature. They give me a beautiful car. I'll never forget it. I'd always wanted a Thunderbird. And the guy comes to see me and he says, now we have what we call the state auto, the assembly automobile program. You can have any car you want. I mean, any car you want. And I said, can I have a black Thunderbird? You got it. It was a 1963 black Seabird. Any of you remember that with the humps? God, what a machine. And it had license plates on it that said, member, California Legislature, A72. Now, this was in the days, it isn't true now, but in those days, Anita, the legislature set the salaries of the highway patrol. It was entirely up to the legislature. California highway patrolmen didn't arrest the assemblymen in those days. They do today because they don't say, not just because of that, but for other reasons. But I would drive, when I said I hadn't been to Fresno for a long time, I used to come through this town, I used to admit, if one of the statues, this is being taped right now, I'm just kidding. I would come through this town, you know, 9,500 miles an hour. Remember one time between here and Bakersfield, I forget what town, I was driving toward Southern California, and it began to rain. And I turned the windshield wipers on, and they wouldn't work. They were going back and forth, but it didn't work. And I looked down, and I was going 100 miles an hour. And what the trouble was that the wind would hit the windshield and move the blade up off of its collapse. So I had to slow down to about 70 before the rubber would come down and touch the glass as it went back and forth. Arrogant dude. Let me say one thing. I want to interject one little thing here because I get to talking about alcoholism and alcoholics and how bad it was. The truth is, during all this time, you know what? I was a great member of the legislature. I really loved serving. I was a good member. I did contribute a great deal to the state of California, and I'm very, very proud of the fact that I was in both on the city council and a member of the legislature. As I talk and kid and joke about those times and kind of self-defacing, rundown stories that I hope you'll identify with, I do want you to know that I did go to work every day. I worked hard as hell, and I was a good member of the legislature. But I was also this booming, budding, oncoming alcoholic. And these times when I would run over the line, used to be every 2 or 3 weeks, now it was getting to be every week or every few days. One of the things about being in the legislature that many years ago, there was 120 members of the legislature and about 800 or 900 registered lobbyists, and those lobbyists' job, still to this day, then, was to give anything that they could to get the attention and the good feeling of the legislature. That's what they were paid to do. And it was just, my drinking continued, but I kind of went up the scale on the things I drank. Good whiskey and good cigars and a good time was had by all in the evening hours. And I got to drink so much that I finally, in the election of 1974, actually didn't even campaign. I was so screwed up. My wife had left me by this time, had gotten mad and took off, and my alcoholism got to the point where I couldn't function. And luckily, and I thank God tonight, and I have 100 times since, people did not vote for me in the June primary election of 1974 simply because I didn't campaign. I was too drunk and too screwed up in order to go out and put on any kind of a campaign, and I was thrown out of office. Well, that was in June of 74, and I didn't leave office till the end of that year. And my attitude at that time was, those dirty, rotten, no good, lousy people that didn't vote for wonderful me, the hell with them. I just had this terrible feeling of rejection and anger, and I really poured the coal on, drank almost to death from that day until the 15th day of September 1976, which is my sobriety day. It'll be 25 years this year. I mean, in Sacramento, then, they used to have a hospital that actually treated the disease of alcoholism. It wasn't, you didn't have to sneak in there with a bad liver or something. It was called a care unit, and you went right to the front door and gave your name, and that's what happened to me. My son checked me in, called the hospital, and signed me up, and I went out there on my last drink. Was, I guess, the 14th of September. I finished off the rest of a bottle of Jack Daniels in the parking lot of that hospital and went in there and submitted myself to whatever the heck they wanted to talk about. I hadn't had a bath for about a month. I had a broken arm. This arm was broken. I didn't even know it. You know, you got two bones there between your wrist and your elbow. Both of them were busted. I didn't know it. And I just was a real mess. I was, of course, in the wheelchair. I didn't have a power chair in those days, so I've got one busted arm and sitting in a wheelchair. And when you have a broken arm and you're in a hand-controlled wheelchair and you can only use one arm, all you do is go around in circles. So that's what I was then doing. I guess I just go around in circles. So they got me in there and got me in bed and cleaned me off and gave me a shower and all this stuff and got the medical stuff done that they had to do. And one of the things that they suggested at this care unit, all what they would do during the day is you'd go to lots of lectures about what the World Health Organization has to say about the disease of alcoholism and how alcohol affects the liver and all of this stuff, which is all very, very interesting and wonderful, and I remember it distinctly. But one of the things that they strongly suggested that we do was go to an AA meeting every Sunday night. I had never in my life heard of AA. I think I'd read about it in a magazine one time, and I'd just heard people joking about it. But can you believe that here a member of the legislature, a former member of city councilman, a guy in broadcasting, had never heard of AA, but I really hadn't in 1976. I'd heard of it, kind of like you hear about the Rosicrucians and the Rotarians and the, you know, the Auto Club. I had some vague idea that there was a group called AA, but I didn't know what it was. I'd never been to a meeting. I didn't know a thing about it. And the reason I dwell on that is because if I had known anything about it, I probably would have formed a bad opinion. But I was lucky enough that I didn't know what it was. I thought, what the hell, I'll go to one of those AA meetings. It was on Sunday night in the cafeteria at the Mercy San Juan Hospital in Carmichael. Went down there. And it was a meeting room smaller than this, but not different from you tonight, not different from us. Big, bunch-looking folks sitting around having a meeting. And I went to the meeting, and I sat and listened to it, and the unit was upstairs, and all the patients would come down and go to the meeting. There was nothing particularly interesting that was said. I don't remember. I kind of guess I heard him read the steps. I didn't really identify with anything. I kept waiting for something to be said or done, or some load, or maybe some hidden handshake or a secret word of some kind. Nothing really. I think it was on the second step, and there was probably 35 or 40 people, and they kind of shared, you know, a couple of laughs here and there, and some real bad coffee. Everybody smoked in those days, so the whole room was full of smoke. An hour and a half meeting, and they got up, said the Lord's Prayer, which was a little bit difficult for me. It was a little bit uncomfortable that to hold hands and pray, but I was able to get through that. Went back up to the unit, didn't think anything about it. It was just, you know, it was nothing all that fabulous about it, frankly. Went through all the whole next week of lectures, and then the next Sunday night went down to the same thing. So I've been in the hospital for 4 weeks. I went to 4 meetings. Nothing really profound that I could figure out. Still haven't figured it out. But you know what? I got out of the hospital and kept going back to that meeting. I'd go every week. I didn't go 90 meetings in 90 days. I hadn't heard about that, but I went every week. And about 3 months, it suddenly dawned on me, for some reason that I'm still unable to tell you, I had lost the compulsion to drink. I didn't even think about it. It hadn't even dawned on me. It just simply happened. There is a magic for me just by attending AA meetings where I was miraculously relieved of this obsession to drink. Because prior to that, I was a daily blackout, pissing, drunken mess up until the day when I took that last drink at Jack Daniels in the parking lot on the 14th of September. And about 2 or 3 months, I used to hear people, I'd sit in that meeting, and there usually was a little lady, I remember, she would knit. I thought she was knitting a tarp for the infield at the Dodger Stadium or something. I don't know what she was doing, but she was always knitting. And they would call on her, and she would say something like, when I came through those doors, God miraculously took from me the compulsion to drink. And I would think to myself, I can confess to you now, I'd say to myself, I wonder why they let those demented old bastards in the meeting. She sits around here and clicks those goddamn knitting needles all the time. And then they call on her, and she always says the same thing. God miraculously took from me the compulsion to drink. I mean, can't we have, why didn't she tell us something? Yeah, I was really a negative, rotten, self-centered bird. But then, now, man, about that third and a half month, it dawned on me one day, she was telling my story. I just came to AA, and God miraculously removed from me my desire to drink. I hadn't had a drink for three months, and I hadn't needed to have a drink. I didn't want to have a drink. I hadn't actually even thought about it. It just kind of went away. Isn't that a miraculous thing? Because you know what? That is a very, very common story if we hear about it. We get here, many of us get here in different ways. The way I got here, I've just told you. Of course, it was just the beginning. I did continue to go to meetings. I always have gone to meetings. I go to 3 meetings a week now. And I continued to go and go. And I want to tell you that during about the third or fourth month of my sobriety and going back to the hospital at Mercy San Juan Hospital in Sacramento, one of the people that I met was the lady who invited me to come and speak here to you tonight in a register, and then Rita, who came in there to that unit, and that's where we met a long, long, long time ago, 23, 24, almost 25 years ago. And boy, she was a very, very, very important part of my early sobriety in those very early days. I owe her an enormous debt of gratitude. Can I ask you to just give Rita another round of applause? Just for two lives. Eva Mendoza, you have an emergency call. You have an emergency at home. Eva Mendoza, is that the right name?
Yeah.
Are you here, Eva? Well, huh? You know who Eva is? Hi, Eva. You're not Eva. Okay. Anyway, thanks for clapping for Rita. I don't have the right to tell her story, but I do want you to know that she's a very important part of my story, and that we were together very, very early on, and she taught me a lot about the program in those early days. And boy, was I green and unknowing and unknown. I really didn't know what the hell was happening. But I just didn't drink. The only thing that I did right
was that I didn't drink and I went to a lot of meetings. And that was the foundation, the beginning of my survival, which has been continuous for almost 25 years. But you know, one of the things that has occurred to me in recent years is how wrong I was at that time about some things, and that's what I really want to share with you tonight. I was one of the people that really believed, I know this now, I really believed that I was a pretty good guy, basically, had very few problems. My problem was that I drank alcohol. And that my problem was as a drinking alcoholic, that was screwing up my life. And I was making bad mistakes and doing bad things behind my drinking. And so it occurred to my fascinating mind that if I didn't drink alcohol, I would be, if that could be removed from me, that everything would be great. Everything would be fine. I would be that nice guy, that well-adjusted sweetheart of a dude, and everything would be great. And I labored under that delusion for about 15 years in AA. Because what happened is, my story, to tell you the truth, it ain't your story, it's my story. And that's the only story I got, so I got to share it. What happened to me was, I didn't drink anymore. I steadfastly did not drink. I did continue to go to meetings. I did sponsor even a few people. I got a sponsor. I did all the things that I heard I was supposed to do. But a fundamental thing didn't change, and that is that I didn't change in the areas of life that had constantly given me the most trouble. My problem was, and I found it in the fifth step in the 12x12, I was incapable of fashioning a relationship with another human being. What I did was, everybody that I would meet, I would marry. I have been married, and I've been married 6 times. I've been divorced 5 times. I was married and divorced so many times that I have rice pockmarks right here on the side of my... And I thought, when I got into AA and got sober, I really sincerely thought to myself, God damn, finally, this is over. This is over. I've been married and divorced 3 times drunk. And now, that's what the problem was. So I got married again, and it ended about 5 years. It ended. It ended in divorce. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. The 3 drunk marriages and divorces, I kind of figured that. But a sober marriage and divorce, I really had a hard time swallowing that one. But, you know, it was painful, it was expensive, and all the stuff. And I tripped along, and pretty soon I met this lovely, comely young lady from Lodi, and I got married again, and finally, this is it. This is it! I mean, you know, what the hell, 5 times? It ended in divorce. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. I really goddamn couldn't believe it. It almost killed me. I'm 15 years clean and sober in AA. I go to 3 meetings a week. I put $2 in the collection plate every time I come to class. Not one, $2. I'm sponsoring 3 guys. I've read the guy, I even read as Bill Season. I mean, you know, what else can I do? I thought I was going to die. I really thought I was going to die. I finally began to read some of the literature. I want to commend the one to you tonight that I read. Anybody ever read a thing called the 12 and 12, 12 steps? You know, Bill Wilson wrote that 12 and 12 when he was about 15 years old. In the big book, in our beautiful big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 6th step and the 7th step have about 1 paragraph each. You know, just kind of mentioned as he moves by. Because it was written in, what, 1938 or 39? When they only had 3 or 4 years sobriety, they had the steps, but they didn't, you know, I mean, they hadn't, nobody really worked them, I guess. Don't get me wrong, I love the big book of AA. I think it's the most fabulous piece of literature of the 20th century. But when he got around to writing the 12 and 12, there he had about 12, 15, 16 years of sobriety, and the man had really been through it. And in the 7th step, that fabulous 7th step, in the 12 and 12, I'm reading this bugger, and it says in there, sometimes we have to go through a painful process of ego puncturing. Painful process. It's at the end of a long road that we finally get to this part where we are ready to reach for humility because we want it, rather than having to be bludgeoned and beaten into it. Now, I used to read that, and I thought, God, to be bludgeoned and beaten into it. Now, I used to read that, and I thought, God, Gavin was being a little dramatic, you know? That was a, I just thought, you know, as a man, I was getting kind of being a little, but let me tell you something. When I read that, at that year of my 15th year of sobriety, the year of my fifth divorce, my second sober divorce, bludgeoned and beaten into humility was just about to despair. In fact, he uses another term in there called groveling despair. I couldn't understand what groveling despair. I heard somebody talk one time about being on your hands and knees and going backwards, and that's where I was. You know what? This probably isn't your story. I don't think that it happens to a whole too many people, but I've just got to tell you tonight, it happened to me. I was finally brought to my knees. I didn't know what to do. I went down. I'll tell you how bad off I was. I couldn't drive. I was in as bad a physical shape behind this emotional Waterloo that I'd reached as I'd ever been behind drinking. I had to have a girl who worked for me, my secretary, drive me. I called up and made arrangements to go into a hospital in Southern California that Claudia Black runs. She wrote a book called It'll Never Happen to Me, wonderful lady. And I had to have my secretary drive me down there because I was unable to drive the car to Southern California. I literally couldn't do it. I hadn't been eating. I was a mess. I was a mess. And I got down there and I went into this hospital in Southern California. Now, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, they had me doing things down there that I goddamn guarantee you I would never have done if you'd have had a gun on me. Those limp-wristed faggots had me talking to my inner child. Can you believe that? I mean, I tell you one thing. I used to go, there used to be an ACA meeting out there in Roseville. And they, people would sneak into that meeting carrying little teddy bears, ribbon on an ACA or the pack of teddy bear with them. Grown people with their own teddy bear. I used to hold those folks in real low regard. I got myself a teddy bear. I'm at that hospital down there, and this psychiatrist says to me, you have to get in touch with your inner child. Now, I knew that that guy had the key. If I didn't get in touch with my inner child, he would let me out of there. So my motivation was to do whatever in the hell it was that guy said. And you know what? I started, and he said, once a day, John, I want you to go somewhere on this campus, it was down in Cerrito, all alone, and talk to your inner child. He gave me a little script to read. I've written on a yellow pad. And I would go sneak away, you know, outside something, and I would read that to my inner child and mean it. And you know, I began to feel the presence of that inner child. And another thing he said to me was, I want you to write to your inner child. Can you believe that? I mean, I get a little bit back of my neck wiggles when I think about writing a letter. But anyway, he says, I want you to take a pen in your right hand, whatever your dominant hand is, and write a letter to your inner child. It's a very simple, loving letter. And then put the pen in your left hand, and he'll write back. I figured this guy needs a drink. I was really worried. But when nobody was looking, I wrote a letter. Dear John, I want you to know that I love you. I want you to know that you can come out and play. You are safe. I don't remember all the lyrics, but it was just something. I love you. I want to provide a safe home for you, whatever the line was. And I put the pen in my left hand, and folks began to write back. It was real scrawly, hard to read. But I actually got a few words. I wasn't thinking of it. My hand, it's almost like a Ouija board. Anybody here ever play with a Ouija board? You know what I'm saying? My hand started to move. I'm getting a letter back from this bugger. It was almost scary. Then these little reading things that I had began to take on a kind of a spiritual essence. So I was getting serious about it now. I would go away from all the other patients and kind of hide in an unused room and read to my inner child. And I get this feeling. Another thing that they had me do was I had to write a letter to my dead father. My dad had died in 1951. And then I had to write a letter to all of my relatives. But the tough part is I had to read those letters to the assembled all of the patients in the hospital. I just thought it was a terrible thing to do. My dad had been dead since 1951. I'm going to write him a letter. So I had to do it. So I wrote the letter, you know, and I then it come the day for me to read that letter. And I got that letter out, and I had to read it to the class. And about halfway through the reading back of this letter, I began to have these feelings of emotion and grief and sobbing like I haven't done, I don't know, remember when. And it was a real cleansing. I'm not advocating any of this, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just telling you what happened to me. Well, I was down there for 5 weeks. I went back home to Carmichael, and the funniest thing happened. I had this lovely home in Carmichael, and I got a nice swimming pool in the backyard, and I used to think to myself about my grandkids, I hate it when those little bastards come over here because, you know, they rub peanut butter on the screens, and they grab my cat by the tail, and they break things. I just didn't like kids. I didn't want the little bastards around. I'd meet them in a restaurant downtown, but I didn't want them to come. This is before I went away. Now I'm back, and I'm sitting in my backyard, and I'm thinking to myself, hey, everything about this backyard is perfect. The lawn is mowed, hedges trimmed. There's a guy that comes and cleans the pool. You can read a 25-cent piece of bait all the way through the water. There was nothing out of place. It was just sterile and neat and terrible. I'd have given anything if one of those grandkids would come over and swim in the pool. But they're not going to come over and swim in the grandpa's house because they could tell they didn't like them. So what I did was I started calling them up one by one. I take them on a pizza. And the funny thing is I found out that I love children. I love babies. I always hated them. I like W.C. Fields, who said that he hated kids. You know, I had a big picture of W.C. Fields in my garage. And remember that, I love that picture about him holding that kid on the golf course, you know, trying to strangle him. All of a sudden, that didn't seem funny to me anymore. All of a sudden, I had this wonderful, warm, compassionate, loving feeling for children. And I now think that that's because I'd come to terms with this inner child, I guess. I don't know. I really don't know the answer. All I do know is that I fell in love with this wonderful collection of people called my own grandchildren. I've got 11 grandchildren. They are fabulous. A bunch of them are mine from my kids. A bunch of them are from my wife and her kids. But anyway, they're just all over the place. And you know what? They're clean. They're neat. They're intelligent. They're smart. They're lovely. God damn, they're great kids. I would take two or three of them, and we'd get in the car and take trips and drive over to Las Vegas for a week. We just went out to the Boulder Dam. We went down to Palm Springs. I took them all down to that thing down there by L.A. with all those rides up in the sky. What do you call it? 12 Flags or something. I personally can't stand the goddamn rides, but the kids loved it. We got a hotel room, a couple of rooms, and they just had a ball. They ranged in age from about 4 to about 15 years of age. And I fell in love with these bunch of human beings that were my own grandchildren. Because, I guess, I had gotten rid of the anger and the hate in the pit of my stomach about myself. I finally had gotten to the point where I could reach out with humility and love and embrace my own family. The pride and the ego and the anger and the self-centeredness had kind of begun to wash away. You know, no matter whatever happens to me, if nothing else ever happens to me, the fact that AA opened the door for me to be teachable enough to do that one thing has meant so very, very, very much to my life today. I was able to finally, believe it or not, I know you're wondering, I had known this lady for a very long time, but I had never had any emotional or romantic feeling about her. We'd been at AA, she was the general secretary of the Roosevelt group, and we would go out to dinner once in a while, and we did fall in love and married. I'll be married 4 years this August to a lovely lady named Linda,
We haven't had any fights. There's no battle going on. The war is over. You know, the fights are done. It is really, I believe, been a miraculously cleansing thing for me to go through. And I want to tell you, I know that there are places in AA where they get mad if you talk about things like inner child work and all that kind of stuff, but it's my story, and it happened to me, and I know that I would never have been able to think about it or open the door to it in my mental attitude if it wasn't for the fact that I had this basic training in the love and the miracle of AA. I remember reading, and some of you do too, that our founder, Bill W., suffered himself from great anger and great depression. I read one time that Bill Wilson would go to bed, had been in bed for a week, with paralyzed with the depression that he couldn't get out of. And I believe it was Father Dowling who came to see him from Detroit one time, and he said he wanted to meet the great Bill Wilson, and they took him in the back room, and there laying in bed was Bill Wilson, laying in bed, bedridden because of a depression. And he began to talk to Father Dowling, and Father Dowling says, Bill, your problem is that you wrote the steps, but you haven't done the steps. And he says, what you need to do is to do a four-step inventory, do all these things. Now, that must have been really humiliating for Bill. I mean, after all, he was a great, wonderful Mr. Bill, but he did do it at Father Dowling's suggestions, and because of that, was able to have the kind of love and spirit in him that helped him to write those passages that I referred to you earlier. My feeling was enormously touched once my mind had opened up through pain to be able to read that part about the end of a long, long road of painful ego puncturing. And the painful ego puncturing for me was to have to write stories to my inner child, etc. But it worked. That suggests one thing to me, that my mind has got to be open for all the rest of the wonderful gifts that can be mine as I continue trudging my road to happy destiny. Well, I had another one that I completely forgot about. I do work, I want to tell you what I'm doing now, and because AA has helped me out so much in all of my life. At about the time I got out of the hospital setting there, and I'm telling you about it, I've been thrown out of public office. People wisely got the hell rid of me. But I sobered up, and I was sober, and I went downtown to figure out how to earn a living, and I was able to get a job as a lobbyist. Now, I'm one of those lobbyists that I talked about earlier that buys all the booze. I do occasionally buy booze, but it isn't really part of the job so much anymore. So I've been working for the last 20-some-odd years in Sacramento as a lobbyist. And I represent counties. I represent San Bernardino County and Riverside County, which is wonderful because they're just far enough away that I don't have to see them that often, and that's just kind of a joke. I don't mind seeing them. I see them in Demonte. But I do represent those two counties down at the state capitol, and I take care of all the affairs that have any interest to them. And let me tell you the funny thing. Here's the funny thing for me. I don't know whether this is coincidence. I don't know what it means, but it causes my stomach to twitter almost with joy when I think about it. The man who was the big boss at the county, the top number one guy, gray-haired, very distinguished-looking kind of a dude. If you were walking in the room tonight, you'd grab your wallet. I mean, he really looked good. 17 years in AA. The guy's a real rock-ripped, fabulous member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it had nothing to do. It just happened. I met the guy. I couldn't believe it. What a sweet guy he is. His name is Tom. The man who is the number one chief of all the law enforcement down there has got about 2 years clean and sober in AA. And these guys go to meetings. They go to 6:30 a.m. attitude adjustment meetings. Can you believe that? I didn't even know anybody was up at 6:30 in the morning. I used to go, I'm being on my way home at 6:30. I cannot go to early morning meetings. But they get up twice a week and go to early AA meetings down in Riverside County, and then they go down and run the county government. They are wonderful guys. They're just regular guys like you and I, but they have been very successful in life, but they're really God-fearing, loving, program-loving members of AA. It is wonderful to be with them, to work down there with them, and to have the joy and the thrill of meeting guys, you know, at work, and then you find out one little word or something or an attitude or a bumper strip, I don't remember how it happened, and bang, you find out that they're also members of AA. It is wonderful to be surrounded. I work down at the Capitol every day. The man who was the head of the Senate now, who's a wonderful fellow, many of you may have read his name in the papers, Senator John Burton. Johnny is an old friend of mine from many, many years ago, and he's a very astute defender of the program. He's a member of NA, has been for many, many years. His sponsor is Wilbur Mills, former chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. And the guy, I didn't even know. I was going down the street in Sacramento one night. I heard this guy screaming out of a car. And I thought I was hearing an echo or something. And I could hear this voice, and he was yelling, "Rarely have we seen a person fail thoroughly fall on our bed." And I looked at his Burton hanging out the back door of this car yelling at me. And it was his way of saying, "Hi, how are you? We're both in the fellowship." And this guy runs the Senate. There are several members now of the legislature who are members of our fellowship of AA, actual go-to-meetings. I mean, these aren't just folks who went to a meeting, but are ongoing members, active participants. When I was there 30 years ago, it seemed to me like everybody drank. Everybody drank booze and everybody smoked. Not everybody, but almost everybody. Of course, that was I'm seeing the world through the perception of my eyes. Now, it seems to me like there is a kind of an acceptance of the whole idea of recovery and the fact that it is a fact of life and it can happen downtown while you're going to work every day. Four brothers of mine are alcoholics, two of them died drunk. My dad was an alcoholic. All of his brothers were alcoholics. Everywhere in the whole family, it just seemed to permeate every part of our family. But there's something that I found out that I'm delighted about. That is that recovery also travels through families. It is absolutely uncanny. One person comes into the fellowship, stays in the fellowship, doesn't necessarily 12-step, you don't have to leave tracks laying around, that kind of stuff, and it begins, one seed is planted, and it begins to spread. It's incredible. It is so phenomenal from the perspective of 25 years to look back at the number of people in my family. I have a cousin up in Oregon who was clean and sober. Both of my kids, my son has got going on 8 years in AA. My daughter is clean and sober about 6 years. It's just unbelievable. My wife's son-in-law has now got about 6 months. And there's no pressure. No, we don't leave big books around or dragging the meetings. It's just it seems like the most effective 12-step work we do on families is just to stay sober ourselves and be honest and sincere about our own recovery. And when we think and enjoy and practice our recovery, it has this contagious effect. I'm here to announce tonight that recovery is contagious and it spreads through families just as much as the disease in prior years spread through families. Isn't that an incredible thing to know? You know, the power of recovery, the power of AA, the power of the spirituality of our program is an enormous thing. It is really an enormous thing. I take great joy in the number of people who practice daily our program at a personal level. My personal favorite hero, I've never met her, but Betty Ford is someone who I think is a hero because she has been an active member of the program but has never broken her anonymity at the public level. She once in a while will have like a big book on a table or the steps will be behind her in a photograph or in a TV interview, but she has never broken the anonymity clause. Yet she, I understand, is a very active member of our fellowship. And a very thrilling thing for me was that I got a tape the other day from a friend of mine. And I'm sure you know about this. And at a meeting level, we can break anonymity, so I'm not hurting anybody. And it was Tony H. who gave this great talk down in Santa Monica about his life and about his... And just a wonderful guy. And it's Anthony Hopkins, that great actor. Hannibal is a member of our program, clean and sober, working a great program in our fellowship. And, of course, I'm also excited if I can see the guy next door, or the guy at the meat shop, or the fellow who drives the cab, or the guy... I was somewhere the other day, I was at the airport the other night to pick somebody up, and the cop
There's a black cop, a deputy sheriff. You know how when you go to the airport, they seem to be determined to get you the hell out of there or write your ticket? They don't want you to stop or anything. And the announcement is going off overhead. Don't leave your car. Don't turn off the engine. Well, this police guy is coming up, and it's raining in on a yellow slick top and bottom, and he comes up to me, and I said, well, look, I'm just meeting somebody. And he says, okay, back the car up a little bit. He's barking orders. He goes around behind. Well, I got an easy dozen bumper strip on my rear window, and he comes back around to the side. My hand is there. He grabs my wrist and gives me a smile. And he says, you've got a great sign on your car. I'm glad that you're a member of the fellowship. And he keeps moving on. I almost wet my pants. I really did. I was so thrilled. It just warmed. The guy could have written me a ticket. I wouldn't have been mad. You know? I mean, here's this guy out doing his work. It's raining. He probably wishes he was anywhere else. And he takes a second to acknowledge membership in AA. Just a sweet guy. I'll never see him again. I've never seen him before. But for that minute, I was as close to that guy as I've ever been to any human being in my life. The power of the fellowship. All of us know the feeling of driving down the road somewhere on a trip and you see somebody go by and honk the horn in the back and that kind of stuff. It is a powerful fellowship that we're involved in. My personal hero is Clancy Odd. Clancy England of the LA group. Clancy says, and I totally agree with him, that the work that Bill and Bob did in writing the big book has had, the big book, in other words, of Alcoholics Anonymous, has had the most profoundly positive effect on the lives of more human beings on this globe than any other book written in the 20th century. That, of course, would exclude the Bible and all because it was written earlier. But of all the books and all the medical theories and all the health books and all the wonderful things that man has done for the entire 100 years, in his opinion, the big book of AA has positively affected, in a positive way, more people than any other single book. That is a powerful thing to say and a powerful thing to believe. I've always known it, and I learned it in Fresno. I go back to the beginning just for a short story, and I'll quit. I've been in politics all my life, trying to get people to come to meetings and in schools, trying to, you know, buy them free beer, get them a cookie, anything, just to get a few people to turn out. One of the very first conferences I ever went to was in Fresno, back in, must have been in 1977, I don't remember, but it was my first year. So we came down and we checked into the hotel, which was, used to be the Hilton, which is now, I guess, the Duffy Free, got a room there the day before the AA meeting, and then they said, well, it's down at the Fresno Convention Center, which is just down the street. Well, I had been at that Fresno Convention Center many times, going to political events, and they would always have searchlights out front, and the police would have the place roped off during the political convention, and, you know, hurting the people and moving them around, and you'd go inside, in the main room, there may be 200 or 300 people at the political conventions, and it was interesting, but it was kind of a hard attempt. So I get over there to the, this time I go to an AA convention over there, and I notice, the thing that I notice mostly, there's nothing. There's no searchlights, there's nothing, nobody's saying anything. There isn't even a parking attendant. The parking lot was just there. You could use it if you want to. There was only one door open. There's about 5 doors at the convention center, and you can open one. I go inside, and there's a couple of ladies at the card table there. So I paid the $250 or whatever it was, got a name tag, and I'm still running. Where the hell is the convention? There's nothing happening much, you know? Go down to the hall, open the door, go into the room. There's 2,000 people in this room in the convention center. I couldn't believe it. And the guy that was speaking, I've never heard him since, he was an Indian, an American Indian from way up in Canada or somewhere up in Maine. It was the funniest guy I've heard in my life. One minute I'm laughing, and the next minute I'm almost crying with the pathos and the honesty that's boiling out of this cat. And he's got one of these beautiful Montreal-type accents, you know, the American, not the American Indian, but Canadian Indian. That was just fabulous. It was just unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. We're back at the hotel. I wanted to call the goddamn LA Times or somebody. I just couldn't believe that there'd be that many people would show up at the Fresno Convention Center for one purpose, and it was almost like nobody knew or nobody cared. Now I know, of course, that lots of people know, and many, 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 many people care. The crowning moment, how many of you were able to go down to San Diego to the World Convention down there? I know. It was down in San Diego, what, 5 or 6 years ago. I was able to go down there.
we went out to the baseball stadium where the San Diego Padres play baseball. Who? What's the name of that stadium? Jack, what's the name of the guy?
Huh? Jack Murphy.
Thank you. Jack Murphy Stadium. Were you there?
No.
I go to Jack Murphy Stadium. There are 65,000 people in that stadium. 65,000 people. You know how many people that is? That's a hell of a lot of people. I mean, you know, that's like the city of Oxnard, you know? I mean, that's a tremendous number of people. So all the stands are full. The infield is full. There are people in a beautiful flag ceremony from different nations, and hundreds of nations from all over the world. And then they stood, 65,000 people stood and said the serenity prayer. I mean, it sent chills. I mean, here I am, an old hustler, always trying to get groups to come to meetings and stuff all of my life, bribing them, doing anything. And here is it. And I noticed the demeanor of the crowd and the fact that the policemen who were working the parking lot outside, nobody was pissed. Nobody was honking. Nobody was trying to drive over one another. It was just unbelievable. The love, the language of the heart, the common purpose of 65,000 people in one town. They had to put together a whole new bus system just for the convention. And people in San Diego couldn't goddamn believe it. Nobody said they were coming. Nobody said anything while they were there. And everybody felt wonderful when they left. The bartender suffered. The booze thing didn't go up too much. But, you know, we did all the things that people do. We ate fish and chips. We bought buttons. We laughed. We went to meetings. Smoked a lot. They had to forget about no smoking in the hotels because most AAers still smoke, I guess. But anyway, I'm going to close with that just to say to you that this experience of being at one with my fellows in this fellowship, this place where we deal with the isms, or where we remember that alcohol comes from the Bible and alcoholism comes from people. And if you got one, you got them all. You know what I'm saying? I've known people, I was telling somebody at dinner tonight, I saw a guy coming down off a gambling trip. Now, I, as yet, have not experienced my gambling stuff. The reason is, I get so mad that I can't gamble. I go up, I lose $200, I'm going to shoot myself, so I just don't do it anymore. But I saw a guy come down off a gambling trip. Have you ever seen anybody suffering from a run at gambling? It's incredible. So people say to me, you know, well, yeah, but he's a narcotics addict. Oh, yeah. I say, if you got one ism, you got them all. Now, I believe absolutely that there's no such thing as an old junkie. There's only old drunks. Because when you get too old to carry a TV set, you got to start drinking wine. Right? That's just no other way around. Anything that we can get, those of us that have, anything that we can get that will alter our mind, we do. Whether it's eating, screwing, gambling, chasing, narcotics, booze. And then, of course, there's this phenomena of the ACA, the adult, the second and third generation. Somebody told me the other day there's a new group called the Children of Adult Children of Alcoholics. It's called CASA. No, I don't believe it. I think they were lying. But the thing about it is, there is a quality of recovery of our 12 steps and our approach that works. It is true that I went to a few meetings and I didn't have the desire to drink anymore. Something that had been running me, been compelling me all my early life. I do believe in magic. There is magic in AA. There's one other thing, and I promise I'm going to quit. I did find something here in that crazy work of an inner child, in that all the stuff, and that is God. And I neglect mentioning that enough. But I have found there is a tremendous power, the tremendous ability of the power to come into my life when I'm fretting and upset and not doing too well, that comes and calms me like a magic. And my trick is to simply say the serenity prayer. And I said it a lot tonight. I was very nervous about coming and talking here tonight. And I would say the serenity prayer. And it does absolutely work. And that is what I call my God. I can be upset and churning and screwing and banging my head around, and remember to say that serenity prayer. Remember to reach out for some humility, and it will come to me. So I can honestly say
in concluding my talk tonight that I really do thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. But mostly I would like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me my dog. Thank you very much.